Excellent.
Well, good. Well, welcome. As you know, we are doing this remotely. So as you may have heard with our first case, if there are any technical difficulties at any point, if you have trouble hearing us, and likewise, we will let each other know. As you also know, appellant has 15 minutes and 5 minutes for rebuttal, and respondent also has 15 minutes in between the two. With that, if everyone's ready, Marshall, will you call our second case?
Yes, calling case A210901 in the matter of the welfare of the child of AMMR parent.
All right. If you're ready, appellant, please, Ms. Groshek, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Krista Groshek, and I represent the appellant, Amy Marin Rowe. In preparing this case, I spent a fair amount of time reading all the cases that the parties cited. And what this court knows, and certainly what my client knows, is that parental rights under our laws in Minnesota may only be terminated for grave and very weighty reasons. We see this restated over and over again in different ways in the cases that the parties have cited, specifically JKT and NRA EV. AD notes specifically that there's perhaps no more grave matter that comes before the court than the termination of a parent's relationship with the child. And for this reason, appellate courts should exercise great caution in parental termination proceedings, finding such action proper only when the evidence clearly mandates such a result. I was struck by the case that the guardian ad litem cited in his brief, NRA MDO, and this was a case wherein there was a mother convicted of second-degree murder of a child that she and her husband adopted. She was ultimately convicted and sent to prison. And when she was in prison, she had difficulty admitting that she caused this child's death, but was asking to retain rights to a child that she and her husband later conceived and she birthed following or in the midst of this other issue with the adopted child. The trial court in that case found that it was in the child's best interest to maintain a relationship with mother who was in prison for killing its sibling. And the Supreme Court affirmed the trial court after the appellate court reversed, indicating that it wasn't necessary for mother to acknowledge her wrongdoing as it related to the murder or the unintentional death of the first child, for her to engage in therapy in a meaningful way, and for her to have a productive relationship with the child in question, MDO. And the court there specifically found that mother may not be a model parent, yet few children would be reared by natural parents if model parents were the standard, and that's NRA DC. What we have here is a parent, Ms. Rowe, who certainly had her struggles, but what we see is that she was making progress, albeit not to the satisfaction of the agency and obviously the court who made the decision to terminate her parental rights. But what we see is that there was progress. She was in a much different position in June of 2021 than she was in October of 2019, when her own mother, who was the proposed custodian, and I want to focus on the transfer of legal custody and how the court erred in not granting legal custody of this of her five-year-old grandson to the grandmother.
Well, Ms. Groshek, I have two questions for you. The first one has to do with how much she learned during the course of her therapy. And the second one has to do with how we analyze 260C.515, where there is a petition for TLC. And yet that statute says that the court has to find that adoption is not in the child's best interest and there are reasons to separate the siblings. But let me tell you the issue that I have with your client's progress. So in July of 2019, DS, who's a registered predatory offender, moves in with her and her children. Later in October of that year, a CHIPS petition is filed. The kids are adjudicated CHIPS in December, and then there are two trial home visits that end, the first one because of the incident in July of 2020, and then the second one because in January of 2021, she leaves her kids alone in a car in January when she goes into a casino. So that brings us up to within months of when the TPR petition is filed. And in March 6th, she's arrested in Dickinson, Iowa. And then a couple weeks later, the TPR petition is filed. She's telling people she's done with her relationship with DS. And yet in April of 21, that's a month before the TPR trial, she's moved to Spirit Lake. March 25th, DS is stopped in Spirit Lake, arrested, your client's with him. And then in April 14th, at his criminal hearing, your client's there and she says that DS can stay with her. And so to me, she's had since October 19th, when the CHIPS petition is filed, till April of 2021 to internalize what she's supposed to be learning in therapy about keeping her kids safe. And I don't see that she's done that. Tell me where I'm wrong when I go through that timeline.
Well, she certainly wasn't sitting in essentially what looked like a garbage house under the influence of meth. Now, I understand the court still has concerns about the timeline that you just articulated. My position is that the county didn't provide her reasonable efforts to grapple with the very issues that continue to plague her throughout the case, whether that's her chemical dependency or whether or not this is indicative of her not having good insight into the relationship that she has with her intimate partners. We know early on, the social worker on the case testified that she had seen instability in relationships and, quote, codependency and things like that. And that was very much obvious at the beginning of this case. She references what she believes is my client's borderline personality diagnosis. Yet there isn't any meaningful services supplied to my client to remedy that issue. Okay, my client's in individual therapy that she seeks out on her own. She's not given a psychological assessment. She's given a diagnostic assessment. A diagnostic assessment, as the court knows, is sort of a blunt instrument, and it doesn't really delve into serious mental health issues and other problems with trauma and you know what a person might use to cope that is counterproductive to their family's health and their own health. We know that she's never referred to any kind of a program for people in abusive relationships. She's never referred to a program that helps her understand codependency, helps her understand sex offenders and how they manipulate. You know, so if we look at her struggle and this timeline that you pointed out, yes, there was problems. My position is that the agency gave her a cookie cutter case plan. And she sought out services on her own. She didn't get services that were actually going to address the issues at hand that, according to social worker Hebert, these were obvious issues at the beginning of the case.
Well, and I applaud her honesty at the trial that when she testified that she wasn't able to bring child three home, that he still should be in out-of-home placement. And obviously you're familiar with the timelines that a child that age, that the statutes have for children that age, and he was way over the timelines at that point.
Right. However, I think the court was in a position where they could have extended those timelines. They certainly could have chosen to say TPR is not warranted in this case. Instead, we should continue CHIP's jurisdiction because mother is getting closer than she ever was before. And if we look at...
Except, within a month, she is saying that DS can come live with her and he's a predatory offender, untreated from what I can tell from the record.
Right. It's unclear about DS if he's gotten treatment. And at one point he gets looped into the case plan and the agency focuses on whether or not he's going to, you know, follow their recommendations. And it appears as though if he had followed the recommendations, such as testing and checking with the agency might have worked with my client and DS as a family unit. That said, DS, to your point, Judge, did not cooperate. My client continued to have this intermittent on-again, off-again relationship, which is typical of people involved in domestic abusive relationships. And so I think that gets us back to the fact that my client, given the fact that she really didn't have meaningful services, actually did make progress to her credit. And what we know about this child is that he was immensely, immensely attached to his mother. In fact, the agency in its brief specifically noted, not one witness opined that it would be in EM's best interest to sever his relationships with appellant and the maternal grandmother. And yet there's this.
Yes. So here we are. We have this abuse of discretion, and it's not what any of us sitting on the panel would do. And if the judge had gone the way that you wanted the judge to go, we would be reviewing that decision for an abuse of discretion, just like we're reviewing this decision for an abuse of discretion. And so could you address how the judge abused the judge's discretion in the decision that she made?
Well, Judge, I argue that this is actually a de novo review because I think the judge in this case applied the law wrong. Everybody acknowledges in the courtroom that this child needs to have contact with his mother. And there's this misnomer of an idea that, well, we can have a TPR. And just because, you know, people sat on the stand and said, of course, we'll allow contact, that absolutely has no teeth. Likewise, the judge says, well, you know, contact agreements can be put into place, but the reality is they weren't. They weren't. And what we know about a TPR is it cuts off the relationship. And that's why I gave this court, you know, the introduction that I did, because this case was the death of the relationship between my client and this five-year-old child who was so bonded. Everybody agrees that this child needed his mother, loved his mother. And that's one of the things that the court should have more strongly weighted, but instead sets aside and says, well, we all know that contact's going to continue, but that's baseless. And frankly, it's not true. And it gave my client a legal situation where even though she knows that her son needs her, she can do nothing about it. She can't petition a court for contact when she knows that her son is suffering without her. The therapist even said that this child needed to have regular contact with the extended family, with his grandmother, who was essentially a second mother to him. And yet the court sets aside these very important facts and looks at the law in a wrong way, that even though you have a TPR, you can still have contact. That is not true. And so I would urge this court to review this de novo as it relates to the judge's finding that we all know there's going to be contact, so we can still TPR. And she does it based upon a flawed presumption that my client is going to be able to get custody back by way of a TLC. So we know that's not true.
So could you please address how the judge got the analysis wrong on 260C.513A?
Let me pull that up, Judge.
And as it relates to 260C.515.
260C.515, Judge, which one are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at both of them. 0.513 says that a TPR is preferred, and 0.515 says that where there's a petition for TLC, the court must make findings why adoption is not in the child's best interest and why there are reasons to separate siblings.
I believe that the court went in with the position that because contact was going to occur, that she could disregard this other permanency option, that being the TLC. And there was, and the analysis that she gives for why she gets rid of, if you will, the maternal grandmother is she pits what she knows to be the end result permanency option, that being the child's sibling's father, that he's going to be the permanency option and he's somehow a better option. And my contention is the court essentially engaged in what would be normally a family court custody analysis, as opposed to just looking at the petition that was before her, which was the maternal grandmother.
But it was important to the district court judge that the siblings have contact and live together. And there is that preference in the statutes.
That preference can also be set aside if the court finds there's good reason to do so. But there was also no reason in the record for the court to believe that contact between the siblings wasn't going to occur if custody was transferred to the maternal grandmother. There was friction between the parties. And with that, I would add the county also failed to engage all of those family members in a family group conference to iron out some of those differences. And instead, the court used that as a basis to terminate as opposed to transfer, which would have allowed for contact. And that is in this child's best interest. I see I have no minutes. Would the court like me to wrap up? Yeah,
this? No, I'm so sorry. I was writing a note. Yes, that. Thank you very much. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Smith, if you're ready, please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent respondent Des Moines Valley Health and Human Services in this appeal from the district court's order terminating appellant's parental rights to her adopted child, Ian. As the court is well aware, this case is very fact and record intensive, and our time here is limited. So unless particular questions arise for me, I want to focus my time primarily on addressing a couple of issues raised in appellant's reply brief, and then maybe addressing some of the issues that have come up here during appellant's argument. First of all, with regard to appellant's contention, primarily in her reply brief, that the agency provided her with no services whatsoever. This is just simply demonstrably false. The social worker testified at trial about the services offered. Numerous exhibits, which I won't belabor at this point in time, demonstrated the services offered. The district court had repeatedly—
Well, Ms. Groshek says, though, that it was her client who found the services, and I'd like you to address that. And then the second piece that I'd like you to address that I just was unclear of from the record is this: the family therapy component and the referral to SEEDS. As I read the record, Ms. Groshek says that SEEDS didn't provide services to children as young as child three, and yet in the record, your client, the social worker, also said the reason that she likes SEEDS is that it had an in-home component to it. So I didn't understand that part of the case plan.
Okay. With regard to the appellant's claim that the agency didn't provide the services, that she sought those out, one of the specific claims she made is that she referred herself to the Mayo Clinic for drug treatment. There is no support in the record for that. In fact, the record clearly demonstrates the contrary. Her counselor at the Mayo Clinic treatment program testified that the agency, Des Moines Valley Health and Human Services, referred appellant to the clinic both times. That testimony is in the transcripts. It's at page 117 for the first time, and then 144, the counselor specifically testifies after consulting his notes that the referral was made by Ms. Hebert, the social worker from Des Moines Valley. Moreover, the agency provided urine testing. The appellant claims that that's not a service. First of all, this court has recognized that that's a service, and it certainly is a service that's relevant to helping her address her chemical dependency issues because it provides accountability and it's a deterrent to use. That's just manifestly logical. Moreover, when the appellant asked for intensive family-based therapy, the agency facilitated that and made that happen. The testimony about that is at pages 396 and 397 in the trial transcript. And while the appellant initially participated in that service, she then tapered off her involvement and didn't continue. There was a period of time where RM continued with the other two children, not the subject of this particular appeal. And there was every opportunity for the appellant to continue those services, but she on her own chose not to. And those were services, again, that the agency facilitated. With regard to the SEEDS program, I am not entirely sure, just to be honest, from the record, what specifically was going on with that and whether that was available for children at the age that EM was. But what is clear is that the agency was providing family-based therapy and services to the appellant and had made those services available for a significant period of time. All of the children had been participating in the intensive family-based therapy. And again, the appellant simply discontinued her involvement with that service that was being provided. The appellant testified at trial that she didn't complete the case plan. She testified at trial that the child could not be returned to her at the time of trial. And the trial here, to be clear, was never about, there appeared to be no contest at the trial whether the agency had made reasonable efforts or provided services. If you look at the closing argument, for example, that appellant made, the argument focused entirely on which disposition was in the best interest of the child. This trial was about disposition.
Let me ask you this. If we were to agree with you and affirm the district court found three statutory bases to TPR. Which one do you think is the strongest?
I think that neglected and in foster care is probably the strongest of the bases here, despite appellant's arguments to the contrary. There simply can be no argument that the that the child was in foster care, and that second, by appellant's own admission, he could not be returned home at the time of trial. And finally, the record amply supports the district court's conclusion that reasonable efforts had not corrected the conditions that were necessary to get the child to return home, those primarily being the appellant's chemical use. And I would point out, appellant argues, makes much of the fact that there was only one relapse. First of all, I think the argument, the record supports the fact that there were two relapses over the period of time. And second of all, she also tries to claim that she admits the December 2020 relapse. That's not what she admitted at trial. What she admitted was that the test was positive. She never admitted and continued to deny that she had in fact used methamphetamine, despite the fact that laboratory tests had confirmed she did so. And that demonstrates that she has not internalized what she's been learning in her treatment program, and she is not living a life of sobriety.
Counsel, can you tell me, when is the second relapse, and what specifically did the district court find about what you described? I assume the December 2020 is the first, is that correct?
It's actually the second in time, if I remember correct. I think there was, and I'm looking at the district court's order now, but I think there was an April 2020 use of alcohol, if I remember correctly.
Okay, so the April 2020, so a full year before the petition alcohol, yeah, and then December 2020 was the of relapse. And then the petition is what, 3 or 4 months later, right? And the trial 6 months later, something like that.
Yeah, the TPR petition is in March and the trial commences at the end of May. Yes. Yeah. And that's, I would direct the court to findings 18 and 19, well, 17, 18, 19, 20 in the district court's order. And again, there's ample evidence in the record to support the district court's conclusion. There simply can be no argument that the district court's findings of fact on those points are clearly erroneous.
And just to be clear, between December 2020 and then the trial, there are no findings or there's no evidence of use.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But again, at trial, appellant was still maintaining her sobriety date was October of 2019 and denying at least the December 2020 use.
Was there any explanation in the record for the delay in her starting the second course of treatment? Because I know a point is made that, oh, she waited several months.
Not that
was on her, or if that was the program, or if I was waiting on a referral, or is there anything in the record on that?
I don't remember anything in the record on that right off the top of my head.
And then how do you respond to Ms. Groshek's argument that this really should be de novo review because the court, and I hope I'm not misstating the argument, I think it's because the court incorrectly applied the best interest factor.
My response to be would be that there is no statute, there is no authority in the case law for de novo review. First of all, I submit that the court correctly applied the standard and determined that the termination was in the child's best interest and that there was nothing amiss about the manner in which the court did so. And this court and the Supreme Court have been abundantly clear that these decisions are reviewed for an abuse of discretion, not de novo. The court correctly applied the correct legal standard. It would certainly abuse its discretion if it didn't apply the correct legal standard, but that's not the argument that the appellant is making, as I understand it. She's arguing that it applied the legal standard wrong. The question then is whether that application of the legal standard is an abuse of discretion based on the facts. And here, there were ample facts to support the district court's conclusion that termination was in the best interest of the child. And it's important to remember that this court doesn't get to reweigh the factors that are considered in the district court's conclusion that termination is in the best interest. Just because this court or any other court might weigh those factors differently and put more emphasis on one factor versus another does not mean that the district court abuses its discretion when it reaches a decision. As Judge Riley pointed out, had the district court not terminated here and instead ordered a permanent transfer of legal custody, the agency would have been faced with an abuse of discretion standard on appeal. And I think it would have been a difficult row to hoe for the agency to challenge that decision as an abuse of discretion. But it's important to remember that just because one decision isn't an abuse of discretion doesn't mean the contrary decision is an abuse of discretion. That's what discretion is. It means that the facts and the law permit different results. And could you district speak, courts.
Counsel, could you speak to the argument that whether it was under a de novo standard or abuse of discretion, that to the extent that the district court's decision making wrongly assumed that there could or would be continued contact with mother, that mother would have some sort of rights to perhaps demand such continued contact, that was an abuse of discretion since termination would actually terminate her rights with respect to that.
So I think it's important to examine the first premise here, which is, yes, that termination does terminate the parent's parental rights. And that's the legal consequence of it. But the practical consequence, which I think is what the court was considering in determining the best interest of the child here, is that that's not a no contact order. Just because I don't have a right to meet to do something doesn't mean I'm prohibited by law from doing so. It means I simply have no right to bring an action to compel the enforcement of what I want to do. And there's nothing in the law that prohibits contact. And the RRM who ended up being the proposed permanency placement, proposed adopted father, testified under oath that as long as appellant was sober, he would allow contact between appellant and EM. And for appellant to suggest that the district court was not entitled to believe that testimony given under oath and weigh that in analyzing what was in the child's best interest, appellant is wrong. That's simply second guessing the district court's credibility determination, quite frankly. The district court relied upon that testimony in reaching its conclusion. The district court acknowledged that there was a bond between the appellant and the child, and that contact between the appellant and the child would be in the child's best interest going forward.
But that's and not based, an enforceable right, I guess, is the point, right?
Well, that's appellant's point, is that it's not an enforceable right. But it's not, I submit that it's that the court's not misapplying the law when it says, based on the evidence I've been presented, this is factually possible and will happen, that I can factor that into my decision as to what's in the child's best interest. I see
can
my
I
time.
Ask one more, just really quick question, and that is, what are we to do with the fact that the county's attorney at the district court, I mean, kind of agrees with Ms. Gross, I mean, not that there wasn't reasonable efforts, et cetera, but that transferring custody was what should happen as opposed to termination of parental rights.
I think ultimately that's of no consequence. First, because the Jackson County attorney in articulating that position was not speaking on behalf of the petitioner, the agency. In fact, that position, which he articulated in the district court, was directly contrary to the agency's consistent and stated position. To the extent that he was making that argument, he made it as the Jackson County attorney, not as the attorney for the agency. Moreover, the argument of counsel is ultimately irrelevant to whether the district court abused its discretion in reaching the conclusion that it reached. Again, a decision is not an abuse of discretion simply because other lawyers or judges disagree with it and would reach a different conclusion. I see my time has expired. I simply ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Ms. Groshek, proceed.
Thank you. I'd like to pick up where the court left off, which is that pursuant to 260C.317, the effect of termination is that all rights, powers, privileges, immunities, duties, and obligations, including any rights to custody, control, visitation, or support existing between the child and parent, shall be severed and terminated, and the parent shall have no standing. That's exactly what this TPR set up for my client. She has no ability to see her child, who everybody concedes she should see because he needs her. If you look at the court's findings, the court specifically found that the child's therapist noted a strong bond between the child and the maternal grandmother, and he would hold her hand and want to stay during the sessions. He has a relationship with his biological uncle and cousins. The court reiterates what's already been reiterated here by the agency and by counsel, that everyone agrees that this child should have contact with his mother and his extended family. The court specifically notes that it would be confusing and hurtful to the child if his sisters were allowed to spend time with appellant and he was not. That's exactly what's happening. My client is not able to see her son, but she's able to see her daughters. And people sit on witness stands all the time under oath and say things that they might well mean at the time, but don't have any intention of following through on or later change their minds on. That is what happened when RM sat on the stand, maybe was well-intentioned, but he's under no legal obligation to offer any visitation to my client with this child. And that is hurting the child. This court is an error-correcting court. And if the child's interests are paramount, then making sure that the thrust of the trial court's order is upheld, which is that this child should be seeing his mother, then this court has to reverse and remand this for further hearing. The court has to vacate the TPR order. This case, if you read the order without knowing the ending, right? If you read it not knowing what the court's going to decide, it reads like a transfer of legal custody order. Because we know under termination law, all rights, all obligations, any standing the parent had goes away. It's done. And the idea that maybe, you know, Ms. Brown is not the perfect custodian in the trial court's eyes, the reality is she's a fit custodian. She's a licensed foster care provider. She had this child in her custody for the majority of the case. This child knows her. He's bonded to her. There was no reason to rule her out because the permanency person somehow looked better. And to Judge Riley's point, 260C515 subdivision 47 does require the court to engage in the analysis and saying why TPR is not in the child's best interest. And it's written all over her order. And that is that this child needs to have contact with his mother and the TPR option does not afford that. Would it be illegal? That's a different question. That's not germane to the analysis. The only way you create a legal relationship with a legal right for my client to have contact with her child that everybody agrees she should have because he needs it is through a TLC. That is the only way to get that done. And the SEEDS program, again, the fact that, you know, the child gets referred to a program that he can't even participate in. I mean, that's what we see over and over again for reasonable efforts. Like, I don't know what services are available in that part of our state, but if there aren't very many, you refer to what you have, and if they don't fit, oh, well, maybe there isn't a replacement, but that's not good enough when we're looking at reasonable efforts that are specifically tailored to put this family back together. There's absolutely no doubt that this child needs his mother. And this court recognized it, but she made the wrong legal call. And respectfully, I'm requesting that this court do its job of correcting that error and putting that child in a position where he's got a guaranteed right to see his mother. And the reality is, unless that right is built in, it's not going to happen. And the agency could choose to open a CHIPS petition against RM for allowing contact if they don't believe that that contact is warranted, if they believe mother hasn't addressed issues to their satisfaction, and it's likely they will believe that because throughout the pendency of the proceedings, they felt she lied, they didn't trust anything she said. There's no reason to believe that with this TPR in place, that they will not find fault with RM allowing my client to see her son. And I reiterate over and over again, the order is clear that this child needs contact and the only legal option that affords it is a TLC. And I'm respectfully requesting this court correct that error and reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the panel? No. All right. Well, thank you both. You both did an excellent job of advocating on behalf of your clients, and the oral argument was very helpful to us.